Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode. This event was proudly supported by ARA Group. It was also supported through the Melbourne City Revitalisation Fund, a $200 million partnership of the Victorian Government and the City of Melbourne. It was also presented in partnership with ABCRN.
Well, hello everyone. Here we all are, ready to talk books, writing, ideas, photography, civil war, demons, the bureaucracy of death, and whether you really do need to get to level 42 for an ear check before you can sail off into the light. Hello and welcome to this event at the Melbourne Writers Festival and here at the Melbourne Town Hall. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we speak, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I should add that I do all my reading on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I'm Kate Evans from ABCRN's Weekly Bookshelf program, and this event is supported by the Melbourne Writers Festival's principal partner, the ARA Group, and presented in partnership with ABC Radio National. We're also recording this for later broadcast on RN, so any and all enthusiastic applause is always appreciated. And you will also be able to ask your questions, not a comment, in about 45 minutes or so, courtesy of the microphone stands at the side. At that point, don't worry, we will put the house lights up so that you can see them. But we're here because of the extraordinarily imaginative work of Shehan Karunathilake. Novelist, advertising copywriter, one-time gravedigger, I understand, whose novels are Chinaman, The Legend of Pradeep Mathew, and The Seven Moons of Mali Almeida, as well as winner of the 2022 Booker Prize. Shehan, how lovely to be here speaking with you.
Oh, wonderful to be here. How did you know I was a gravedigger? That was classic.
I read it in an interview, I think, by somebody we actually both know. So there you go. Now, the narrators in both of your novels are these antic, vivid characters who might have behaved badly at times, who wave around a drink or two, we think, while telling a story. So what's the appeal of these slightly wild-eyed characters?
Well, I didn't think they were wild-eyed when you start writing the book. But also, I think with any piece of writing, it's the voice that dictates whether the thing exists or not. So you can have a plot, you can have characters, you can have ideas, but until you have the voice of the thing, it doesn't exist for me. And so with the first book, with Chinaman, The Legend of Pradeep Mathew, which was a full biography of the greatest cricketing genius who happened to be unfortunate to be playing for Sri Lanka in the 80s, I wrote that in the third person, had multiple narrators, but once I realized that a drunken uncle was telling the story, that's when it really came to life and I was able to tell these tall stories. So, and also, we've had our experiences with drunken uncles telling stories, and usually they'll digress, go all over the place, but they all, if you stay there, they come back to their point, and that's kind of how Chinaman worked. With Seven Moons, I did know that it was a ghost solving their own murder. I knew that premise. And then figuring out the character, you know, I'd like to say it came all in a flash and the voice just spoke to me, but it was a lot of trial and error and construction, figuring out who this person is. But it wasn't so much them being wild characters. I think one thing they have in common is they're both journalists. And I often say that people accuse me of magical realism, they accuse me of literature at times. I think I'm just writing straight genre fiction, detective stories. And I've been asked, how come if you're writing detective stories, there aren't many detectives? Why is it the journalists? And I figured, well, I suppose in Sri Lanka, you know, we've lived with many unsolved crimes. And there's no Sherlock Holmes or Poirot who goes in there and twirls the mustache and says who did it. Usually, the crimes don't get solved. And it's the journalists who end up digging up for obscure cricketers or photographs that implicate various parties. And I think in South Asia, these are the true heroes, not so much the crime solvers. So I wrote a crime novel, but had these journalist characters. And having hung out with a few Sri Lankan journalists and journalists from everywhere, I do know that they do tend to like their drink. They do tend to like to pontificate and digress. And I think you have to be a bit mad and a bit wild, especially in Mali Almeida's case, living in comfortable Colombo, to go out to these horrible places, these war zones, and photograph atrocities. So maybe, I don't know, maybe it's also me being quite a tame character, fantasizing about being a bit more wilder, a bit more idealistic, a bit more of an activist, whereas I sit in my room just writing these things. But I haven't really interrogated it, but I think once you just have a character voice that speaks to you and tells you the story, that's when you end up going with it and writing the story.
And both of these characters are ethnically sort of diverse characters in that they are both Tamil and Sinhalese, although in the case of Mali Almeida, his mother is also Berger as well. Why was it important to have these characters of sort of this mixed cultural background?
Again, it's problem solving at a basic level. So in Pradeep Mathew's story, it was the fact that now he was playing just before Sri Lanka won the World Cup. And I remember, as every Sri Lankan does, every rainy day we sit there and watch the 96 World Cup on video cassette. That was ritual. But I remember that in that period, Sri Lanka, you know, we had not segregated, but sports clubs that the Sinhalese Sports Club, the Tamil Union, the Moors Sports Club, the Berger Recreational Club, and the Sinhalese Sports Club dominated sport in that time, but there was one guy, Muthaiah Muralidharan, who the team rallied behind, the lone Tamil in that dressing room. And it always occurred to me that, quite curious, that in the throes of a brutal civil war, where the two races are at each other's throats, that suddenly the nation unified behind this dressing room of predominantly Sinhalese, but this one Tamil bowler. But I just thought, what if it wasn't Murali, it was someone more talented, but in the 80s, how would that person have got through? And also, Pradeep Mathew was a lot more vocal and a lot more, a troublemaker. And so that kind of informed how the story would play out. So Pradeep Mathew being the lone Tamil bowler, because another thing is this, whatever our racial divisions, when it comes to sport, we go for the talent. It doesn't matter where you come from, what your surname is. If you can bowl that Dusra, we will put you in the team. And so that was important there. With Mali Almeida, now he's Malinda Kabalana, so he's got a Sinhalese dad, which, I mean, he's got daddy issues. I think most of my characters have daddy issues. We can interrogate that later. But he's almost ashamed to be, he changes his name to Almeida because his mom's Berger, but this also allowed him to, I think, play with all sides. So he's taking photographs for the Sri Lankan government, for the Tamil Tigers, for the Marxists, and for various foreign interests. So I think the fact that he could pass as any sort of ethnicity that informed the character. So I didn't sit there thinking, you know, in these days of cultural appropriation, you're supposed to just sit in your corner. So I'm supposed to write from the point of view of middle-aged Sinhalese Buddhist men. Which, how dull would that be? And so I try and, look at these, not marginalized, but characters on the fringes who can perhaps criticize Sri Lanka a bit more. But again, it wasn't contrived. I think each novel had its own set of circumstances that informed character.
Well, let's concentrate a bit more on Mali Almeida. Charming, funny, dead. But on the first page, you label him with three words: photographer, gambler, slut. Are they equally weighted?
There's a lot of slutting around, yes. But there's a lot of photography as well, and there's a lot of gambling. That'll be interesting how he does rate his skills, and he rates, his sexual prowess somewhere around the middle, his gambling the same, but photography he rates quite highly. So that's how he'd see himself.
He weighs the odds all the time, though, doesn't he, in terms of taking risks or not taking risks. And he does it in a playful way as well as a serious way.
So this gambling, now I'm full disclosure, I'm not a photographer. I can barely take a selfie. And not much of a gambler. I watched a lot of online poker, but, you know, I don't have a poker face and I can't do math. But this guy sits there and calculates the odds. Because I think the opening gag is an atheist in the afterlife. Now, he's an atheist, perhaps a nihilist, convinced that there cannot be any cosmic plan, there cannot be anyone in charge, because he has seen the most horrible things on the battlefield, and he's seen how humans interact with each other and how they destroy each other. So he was convinced there is no God, there's no system to it, but there's only the random roll of the dice and odds. And that's why every sexual encounter, he's calculating the odds, every time he goes into the war zone. And so that was the interesting premise, but then suddenly he's flabbergasted to find that there is an afterlife. There may be a God, but God has gone for lunch and hasn't been back for a few millennia, and now he's got to navigate these rather complex set of rules and walk into the light and solve his own murder and so on. So the gambling thing was, because the good gamblers, they sit there, you know, the stereotype is chomping a cigar and laying down two aces, but the proper gamblers are sitting there doing equations and grinding it out. And this I found quite fascinating, even though I'm not very good at it myself.
I feel like I keep on skirting around the fact that he's dead, and I promise we will get to more of that. But I wonder if we could just pause a bit more on the fact that this character is a photographer. I mean, you described him as a journalist, but he is a photojournalist, which means he's a witness. And so it feels like a lot of this book is both about photography and memory, which of course is never straightforward, but also what it means for somebody to visualize something and then hold on to something, and the responsibility of bearing witness. And so I wondered, as you developed this story and as you developed this character, whether he was always going to be a photographer.
No, he didn't start that way. So, you know, I've said this many times. My starting point was when I realized I'm setting it during 1989, I looked at the famous and not so famous unsolved murders, of which there were plenty. But the most famous, at least in Colombo circles, was the murder of Richard de Souza, which happened in 1989. And that was my starting point. And his life's well documented, and I met a lot of old friends of his. And when you look in The Final Reckoning, Mali Almeida and Richard de Souza are very different. I mean, Richard was not a war photographer or a gambler. They were both closeted gay men, but Richard was more of an activist and a theater person. But I think with each character, you start off with a real case, but in the end, when the rear... And this thing took so long. It took 7 years to write, so I think the character evolves and becomes their own person. But with photography, when I stumbled on that, because I realized, so one, it's at its basic level, it's a murder mystery. It's except that the corpse is the detective solving their own murder. But also him being a war photographer meant he had this cachet of photographs under his bed, which he believed the world needed to see. And he, even though he was a cynic and a nihilist and atheist, he did believe, and I guess part of it was ego as well, that he found something he was very good at. His dad kept telling him that he's no good at anything, and this is the one thing he was good at. So, and that's how it began. But then he realized he's seeing these things that no one's aware of, either in Colombo or the greater world. And for me also, it was researching this period, because I was a teenager in 89, had very little understanding. It was a very confusing time. And when I later researched 83. So 83 is the riots against the Tamil people, which was the start of the whole mess. You look at 83, you look at 89, there's not much photographic evidence. Every July, July 83 was Black July on the internet. Now, no government has ever acknowledged or apologized, or I don't think there's a memorial even for 83. But Every July we have this internet, let's never forget, but it's the same three photographs that are recycled. And I often wonder, and there's no official death count either. We know it's in the thousands, and we know hundreds of thousands were homeless and displaced. But it always made me wonder, why are there not, was there no one with a camera? And even our war, there are a few selected photographs, but certainly 1989, it's documented, but it's fading from memory. And so either there's no photographs, or there is some photographer out there with negatives sitting under their bed, and this was an enticing prospect that I could recreate these photographs of things that may or may not have happened, and use that to talk about Sri Lanka's past, because as the kids say, you know, photos or it didn't happen, right? And it seems that's our view of history. Because a lot of, like I said this morning, with my first book, I mean, it was a cult success and it did all right. But my fan base was predominantly middle-aged men who are obsessed with cricket. Those are my groupies. And I was quite content with that. But with this book, it's obviously expanded beyond that. And I'm getting a lot of young people, especially in the subcontinent, kids who were born in the 90s, 2000s, who come up to me and say, you know, we are aware that a war went on, but our parents don't talk about it. No one's in school, we're taught about our ancient kings and the colonial legacy, but not about the last 40 years. And that the book at least gets them, and this is all, it's there on the internet and the resources are there, gets them talking about this. But I do believe in the power of photography. Now, 2022, we've had a different type of turmoil in Sri Lanka, but that has been well documented. Everyone had a phone and selfie, so I presume when someone writes a novel about that, there'll be plenty of evidence to, if it's not destroyed, who knows these days, or if the internet will be there in 20 years, but yeah, but this was why him being a photographer, that really also, it separated him from Richard de Soysa and it got the plot into action. But yeah, this idea of bearing witness, of writing, I mean, people say, why are you writing? A few trolls, there are always a few trolls. Why are you writing about our dark past? Sri Lanka's moved on, we should all move on. Why are you dredging up these things? But I believe, and Mali Almeida, and it's all there in the book, that forgetting our past, and I think that's the central conceit of the book. How does Sri Lanka deal with its past? Do we dig it up, scrutinize it, be honest about it, or do we bury it and forget about it? And the latter has tended to be our policy. A catastrophe happens, conspiracy theories, the recent Easter attacks, which is now being talked about, I'm seeing, but for a long time there was a lot of theories about it, a lot of discussion, and then we move on to the next catastrophe, and it's like, yeah, let's not bring up the past, let's just move on. But I don't know if that's worked for Sri Lanka, and I think regardless of what your agenda is, I think as a nation, we need to address our past for our nation's soul and make sense of it, and the main thing is ensure that it never ever happens again.
But one of the other things I really like about this novel, and there are so many things to like about it, is that as well as making us think about the way photography works to bear witness, as we meet this man in this afterlife, and as he comes face to face with the dead who he's photographed, we also come face to face with the ethics of war photography. Because some of these characters who are ghosts like him say, yes, I'm the one who you photographed and my name's not even there in the caption. I'm the one who was photographed, you know, as just a torso. So, and he then recognises these people and he's sort of forced to think about what it means to photograph atrocities, isn't it, by seeing them as talking, walking characters again.
And yeah, they're not very happy with him, and he has to interrogate, and a couple of times he said, yeah, I had to stand on the bodies of dead children to get that shot. And I did talk to a few war photographers I found out William Dalrymple was a war photographer back. He told me a couple of months ago, I wish I'd known then in a previous life, but I interviewed Stephen Champion, a few journalists there, and also I watched the Bang Bang Club and all these, because a war photographer is a very curious creature, and you wonder why they're putting themselves at danger. I'm sure the money is good, but there's better, much safer ways of earning a living. But that rush of getting to this place where no other cameras are and getting that shot and sharing with the world, that buzz, And it's telling that Mali Almeida, whatever money he makes, he ends up at the casino throwing it on blackjack or roulette, because he sort of feels that, that wasn't the purpose of this, and he feels that guilt. But yeah, he's in the end, you're all about the shot, and you sometimes forget the people in the war zone that you're photographing. But I think there is an arc. I mean, it's not all grim. There is an arc where he kind of reckons with the people on the battlefield and what his purpose was and what the purpose of these photographs were. Yeah.
Let's get back to the shape of this afterlife, because when we first enter into it, there are queues and not enough bureaucrats. So what are the elements that you wanted to imagine into this afterlife, which at the beginning, it's you wake up to an endless waiting room?
Yeah, so now that was a technical problem to solve. What do ghosts do all day, and what does the afterlife look like? And you can research that. I read the religious texts. I few near-death experiences where survivors describe the light and walking into it. I read Dante's Inferno, watched Hellraiser a few times, and a lot of diverse influences. But in the end, you can't really interview a ghost, and you don't really have much reliable information from the afterlife. So I had to construct it. And the only thing was, you have to construct it so it's consistent. Because it irritates me reading fantasy or magic realist novels where suddenly in Act 3 he can be invisible or he can breathe fire and you never see that. So I had to have the rules of what a ghost does. There were about 20 rules, but in the end, with Natanya Jans, who I have to give a shout out to, my wonderful editor, we sat down and three crucial rules. So the first one was, can a ghost go anywhere? Then ghosts would end up in the Maldives or Paris or somewhere. So that didn't make sense. So ghosts can only go where their body's been, where their corpse has been. So that's why ghosts only haunt cemeteries or the house that they lived in. You could go wherever the wind blows, within reason. And I was writing this at 3-4 in the morning when the kids were asleep. And at that moment, suddenly a door will slam and a gust of wind will blow past you. And you wonder if there's some creature, demon sitting behind you whispering. I think all writers, when they're in the throes of it, feel that. But I think the crucial thing was you can go wherever your name is spoken. And that was convenient doing a detective story, because wherever the name Mali Almeida was spoken, Mali could go there and find out who was talking about them, which was another suspect. So that was just the ghost. But then the afterlife, what's the system there? And the common illusion or delusion or the self-comforting notion is that when we breathe our last and we open eyes again, everything will be revealed. The universe will reveal its secrets. God will come back and sit next to us and tell us her name and all of that. And, you know, it's a lovely thing to think, especially when you're nearing that. But to me, it made more sense in a Sri Lankan afterlife that you wake up with a piece of paper saying, go over to that counter and get it stamped. The guy's gone for lunch, and then you got to sit there and go to level 42. Yeah, that's a reference to Douglas Adams, not the band. I'm not a fan of good bass playing, but yeah, level 42, you go there. And so this idea of this confusion that these spirits are wandering around like a... And I've spent a lot of time in a passport office in South Asia, in tax offices, and I think a lot of this novel was written sitting there waiting for a parcel from Amazon. You can see the parcel over there, but it's got to be stamped by three people. And I just thought this afterlife makes more sense because it's at least my attempt at an explanation, because this is something that's baffled all of us. Why is Sri Lanka, this beautiful so-called paradise full of so much potential, go from catastrophe to catastrophe? Three separate conflicts in 89, but the story doesn't end there. The war went on for another 20 years, and then the war ended, and then 10 years later we're in economic collapse. What's the reason for this? And the island's been cursed for the last 200 millennia. It's Kueni's curse. But to me, it made sense that it's just bureaucracy. It's just a bunch of spirits wandering around, whispering bad thoughts into people's ears. And perhaps that's why Sri Lanka's where it is. And so one thing I think, you don't think so deeply when you're right. You just think this is an absurd comic first scene. And my first scene of Chinaman begins with two uncles throwing biryani at each other at a wedding, which is an actual event. We can go into that later. But the opening scene's always crucial. And you find out the two uncles were arguing about cricket, about Pradeep Matthew, and that propels the story. So this, for this atheist nihilist to wake up in the afterlife and it's a bureaucracy, and then he has 7 moons or 7 days to solve the murder. That was all, you know, that was the ticking clock and all that. So it was enticing, and I don't usually know where the book's ending. Maybe I should plan it. I'll probably finish it quicker. But it was a good premise to start with. And that's where this afterlife bureaucracy and the different spirit guides and all that came from.
I know you mentioned that this book took you 7 years to write, but I believe there was an earlier version of this novel published 2 years before this one for a Sri Lankan audience, so it had a slightly different title as well. And I'm curious about what changed when you remade this story for an international audience.
So Chats with the Dead was what it was, came out in 2020, just before the pandemic. And it was strange because I'd spent so much time writing this rather complicated story. I mean, you rightly pointed out, there's a murder mystery, there's a love triangle, there's a political thriller, ghost philosophizing and all of that. And I thought I'd finished it. And India and the subcontinent were quite enthusiastic to publish it pretty much straight away. I think because Chinaman had a cult following there and they wanted to follow it up. But also, I guess, things that you take for granted, the complex Sri Lankan dystopic situation, rebirth, the afterlife demons, maybe that's more familiar to a South Asian audience. But it could not find a publisher in the UK, in the US. Publishers who had been fans of Chinaman were saying, well, it's difficult, it's confusing. There are all these different factions and there are all these demons, and we're not sure a Western reader will have patience with this. And so I spent the pan... My agent, who's now my best friend, he didn't used to return my calls, but now he's my best friend. He said, well, you know, it's Sri Lanka, it's a tiny country, and he speaks in a posh English accent. But, and he said, well, it's people have forgotten about your war. I'll try my best, but write me another one, and we'll see what we can do. But we sat there. Finally, when I found Natanya Jans of Sort of Books, a small publisher, and she's always, I've had an editorial relationship with her, and she's always been very generous. She said, well, look, I think it's terrific, but you need to fix the beginning. It's very confusing. The ending doesn't quite land, and the middle's a bit boring. But other than that, it's it's brilliant. And let's. And she's very polite when you get feedback. So the whole pandemic, up till the end of 2021, we were reconstructing. So the initial brief was just, if someone knows nothing about Sri Lanka, about LTTE, JVP, they can pick up the book and have experience. And I think that's the measure of a good book, regardless of prizes and sales. If someone on the other side of the planet can pick it up and have an experience with it. And same brief was there for Chinaman. If you know nothing about left arm leg spin or Sri Lankan cricket, you should still be able to. And that's why there's a lot of cheat notes for people who don't know anything about cricket. So I think we started off doing that, but then you realize it's not going to come out in 2020. It's going to come out in September 2021, and suddenly you have another 9 months. And so what do? You give birth to another. Took out plots. Just I think her main brief to me was, make sure all the instruments aren't playing at once. You have all these different layers. Just make sure the pacing isn't going to lose someone's patience. And so, yeah, it was quite grueling work. I mean, I'm glad it's all done and it turned out okay. But at the time, also, I worked as an advertising copywriter most of my life. So client changing your copy is just part of, that's part of life. And you can go and sulk, or you can just get on with it and make it better. So I was in that spirit of doing it. But yeah, there was a lot of extensive surgery on Chats with the Dead to end up becoming The Seven Moons of Mali Almeida, a title that I hated, by the way, when it was first proposed to me. They said, what do you think of this? And I said, well, the cover's nice, but it's a bit orientalist, isn't it? It's like this wacky, weird novel from South Asia. I go, exactly. we can sell. And Chats with the Dead sounds a bit too, B-movie. Anyway, it turned out okay. Yeah.
Well, yeah. maybe we should get right into some of the supposedly wacky bits, you know, the demons and the creatures who we meet in the afterlife as well. So there's the Mahakali monster, who in some ways is the easiest to understand, but there's who sees all the pain and absorbs it. But there's another character who at the beginning of the story is sort of tattered and in garbage bags and is more of a sort of abhorrent creature. And interestingly, as the novel goes on, he becomes, I don't know whether he is the right term, clearer in focus and almost more attractive and at the same time more dangerous. So I wonder if you could talk about what that figure does in your novel.
So that's Sena Pathirana. So the three crucial characters, they are Richard D'Souza, we talked about, and Mali Almeida has this angel and demon, if you like, these two voices guiding him in the afterlife. One is Dr. Rani, again based on Dr. Rajini Thirunagama, who was a slain Tamil moderate of that period. And she's saying, your life is done, just make peace, forget about it, move into the light and move on. But Sena Pathirana, now he's based on Daya Pathirana, who's not such a famous figure compared to the other two, but he was the first, one of the first victims of the JVP, of the Marxist uprising, a campus leftist who was killed. And his view is that the light is just another bourgeoisie tool that's gonna, it's, you know, walking to the light just means forgetting everything. And if you forget everything, nothing's gonna change. And he says, you know, karma is also nonsense because it just lets us accept our fate, and that's not what we should be doing. We have power in the afterlife. We should be going back and addressing the injustice. And you're right, he becomes more of a powerful figure without giving too much away. But that's the central debate that I alluded to before, this idea, do we avenge our past or do we forget about it? And that's where... and Sena, I wasn't quite sure about him at the beginning, but he does become a formidable part of that plot and of Mali's journey as well. A few headless demons and pretas. I got this from, so in Sri Lanka, so we have Mahayana and Theravada Buddhism. So the Sri Lankan Buddhism compared to the Tibetan version, it's quite different. And as a travel writer, I traveled to, Ladakh and Kashmir. And going to these temples, you see this pantheon. As far as, you know, Buddhism in Sri Lanka and Myanmar, you know, we don't believe in gods and other beings, but the Tibetan Mandalite has this whole pantheon of, animal spirits and hungry ghosts and demons and angels and humans. And so this seemed a good device to populate the afterlife, as well as the victims of the war. All of these characters, these ghosts, end up turning into either pretas or something even worse. That's where all these different ghosts came from. But you're right. Sena and Rani are the two crucial ones in Mali's journey.
And there are things I could ask you about how that sort of seduction of revenge that is something that is plagued with. But I'm interested in the way that as we talk about these characters and these demons, you then refer to real people and real victims in the Sri Lankan Civil War. Given that for Mali there is a real risk in what he does as a war photographer, is it risky for you as a writer to be entwining these real stories in your imaginative world?
Well, I hope not. I had this problem to a lesser extent with the first book, because that was quite closely related to the 96 World Cup, that team. And, I used some not very subtle names. There's Hashan Mahanama and Asanka Ranatunga, and I thought I was being clever. I talked to some lawyers. I said, is there danger of this getting me in trouble? And they said, well, firstly, you're not being clever. You're pissing off two people rather than one person. Well, firstly, they said libel's a tough thing to prove in a court, and also getting sued by a famous cricketer is great for a debut novelist. So, so far, I don't think many cricketers have taken offense. With this one, obviously, it's much darker material, but I felt that writing in 2013, 14, about 89, I felt safer than if I was writing about 2019 Easter attacks or 2009 end of the war, because 89, one thing, it's several catastrophes ago, many of the main antagonists and protagonists are dead, apart from one who's still very much alive and in power, but but also look, there's talking animals in this, there's demons, and so I think if I was writing non-fiction or I was a very well-researched journalistic piece, I may have paused before I publish. But the fact that I was hiding it in this ghost story with all these zany characters, I felt that we should talk about, and I don't think, you know, I'm not saying anything controversial about 89. This period's very well documented, and, you know, if you look at the real story, it's far more gruesome than anything in the book. So, yeah, so far, I look at it as, and I portray it as historical fiction of, four decades ago. But the names are a bit more disguised, but I think the astute reader, especially with knowledge of Sri Lankan politics, would know who these characters are based on. So far, no cricketers or no ghosts are suing me or worse, yeah.
But also, I mean, just to be clear, though, for people who haven't read this, while this is a novel that is drenched in horror in some ways, it's also joyful and funny. He has a lot of sex, although there's a frisson of danger with that as well, isn't there, as a gay man in Sri Lanka. Yeah, yeah. Has that changed since 1989? I guess I'm curious about how important it was that the risks to him in terms of his sexuality be a part of this story.
So I suppose, look, in 1989, not just Sri Lanka, anywhere in the world, being out of the closet could be dangerous. And when I started writing it, this cultural appropriation debate was simmering, but it wasn't quite in the forefront. I'm sure if I wrote now, I'd think about writing from an LGBTQ character's point of view. Because now the question is, a cisgender heteronormative dude, can I write like that? Or from that point of view? And I interviewed a lot of friends, young gay men who are in the grinder generation, which is very, very different from what happened in 89. It also played for character why he would go to these dangerous places, because he felt in Colombo society, even though he was a middle-class English-speaking guy, he couldn't express himself or come out of the closet. And going to these places, he could express himself sexually. So that was one part of it. How it is today is, well, look, the world has come a long way. And I don't know if legislation-wise or legally we've made much progress in terms of LGBTQ rights. I don't think it's on the agenda. I don't think any politician is going to touch it. For now, these things could change. But I did notice during the struggle, during the Aragale of last year, we had a pride parade during that protest. And it's the first pride parade I've seen in my life living there. You have these pride parties in closeted areas, but to be quite open about this, so I think, obviously, we've moved with the times, and I don't, you know, as cynical and as nihilist as the book is, I don't believe that Sri Lankans are bigoted at a cellular level. I don't think we're a homophobic or racist society, and if you look at how just people live in their day-to-day lives, you have Tamils and Muslims and Sinhalese and Burghers interacting and speaking different languages, but it just seems that these ideas surface every time there's election cycle. It's a lazy way to win elections. It's like, oh, watch out for that minority, they're out to get you. And so I think these things come up. But with the LGBTQ question, certainly I think it's much more liberal and much more open-minded, but still we have a long way to go in terms of actual legislation and rights.
But in terms of your novel, I mean, this is, as well as a crime novel, it's a love story. And it's a story about friendship, and it's a chase scene involving demons. But the other thing that happens in this book is that music hums through it as a soundtrack and also at various crucial points as clues. How important is music in your life and your writing?
So Shakin' Stevens, yeah. Shakin' Stevens and Jim Reeves and Boney M. Yeah, I had to pay
and
homage.
Queen.
Yeah, Queen's there and Elvis. Yeah, well, for those of you who didn't guess, I'm a failed left-arm spinner, but I'm also a failed rock star. And, well, not so much star. So I haven't given it up. You can see the nail polish and the man bun. It was called a ponytail back in the day. And... yeah, before I wanted to be a writer, yeah, I just wanted to be a bass player. I didn't want to be a lead singer, just a bass player in a band. And the difference is I never practiced guitar every day. I wrote every day. I wrote every day, and that's why you're compelled to do the things you do. But still, I spend my mornings, my first hour is getting the soundtrack right, getting the lighting right, and that's how I procrastinate for the first hour. So yeah, music's certainly an important part of the writing process, but also... the soundtrack, yeah, both of the characters have terrible music tastes. The first guy, WG, was obsessed with Meatloaf, the Meatloaf, as he used to call it. I am a big fan of Shakin' Stevens. I remember growing up. Did Shakin' Stevens play in Australia?
Certainly heard here. I can't remember. Okay, here.
When I talk to Britain, everyone goes, ah, because, yeah, I remember seeing the Elvis movie and thinking, wow, that guy ripped off Shakin' Stevens. And, but also, yeah, Jim Reeves was standard issue in every Sri Lankan home. All our parents listened to Boney M, ABBA, Jim Reeves. But also, yeah, there's Jackie listens to these morose bands from England, the goth bands, The Cure and Bauhaus. And I think it is each character, I kind of look at their music taste. But yeah, Queen, there's a few Queen albums that are... named during the making of this, and Elvis as well. Yeah, it's an important part of, I always have a soundtrack going, and there's a playlist on Spotify that my friend Ravin put up called Tunes with the Dead, spelled C-H-O-O-N-S, and that's, it's basically 80s bangers, but I guess that's, it helps. These are all procrastinations. You think, okay, what would Mari Almeida be listening to? And you spend 3 hours doing a playlist, and then you write a paragraph. But yeah, music's certainly a big part of it. And yeah, maybe Mari Almeida the musical.
And I do love your character, Jackie, as well, partly because she's somebody who listens and pays attention to Mari, because she seems a bit flaky at first, but she's not really... But I should say that here at the Melbourne Writers' Festival and on ABCRN, I'm Kate Evans, and we've been speaking to Shian Karunatilaka, whose latest novel is The Seven Moons of Mari Almeida. Please do thank him.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers' Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.